You may have looked at today's guest and thought, okay, hold on a second. Art Chamsky. How do I know the name Chamsky? Art Chamsky began his career with the Cincinnati Reds in 1965. He played for those Reds teams with guys like Pete Rose, Vada Pensin, and Frank Robinson, but that's probably not how you know the name Art Chamsky. At the end of 1967, he was traded to the New York Mets, and by 1969, Art Chamsky was the linchpin on a Mets team that went from losing 101 games in 1967 to miraculously winning the World Series in 1969. In fact, during a long stretch of games that year, he batted .343 to keep the Mets in the pennant race, and he hit an astounding .538 in the NLCS to help send them to their first World Series. I can't wait to talk to him about that magical year, and also hear about some of the great old lost ballparks that he played in along the way, including San Diego's beautiful Westgate Park when he played for the AAA Padres. I'm Mike Kozer, and this is the Lost Ballparks Podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The Effingham Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And this should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Go pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Art Chamsky, welcome to the Lost Ballparks Podcast. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Art, I find that one of the questions that helps give context to someone's career in baseball is when and where did you attend your first Major League Baseball game?
Well, I grew up in St. Louis, and obviously I was a big St. Louis Cardinal fan. My dad was an avid fan. He's really the one that got me involved in baseball. Like most fathers, we played soft toss as soon as I could walk. And, I fell in love with the Cardinals. My hero, of course, was the great Stan Musial. And I remember growing up and listening to the games, and Harry Carey was the announcer.
Hello again, everybody. All set to play baseball here.
And I would lay in bed at night just waiting for Stan to come up and bat.
There she goes, deep in the right center. Mays going over off the wall. And Willie plays it perfectly and holds Stan to a long single. That hit the right center field wall on a line. Bounce right back to Mays.
My interest in the game just kind of grew from that. And, you know, the Cardinals at the time were one of the better teams in baseball, always in the mix. And that was really where I grew up in St. Louis and got to learn and play the game of baseball. And a lot of former and now, I guess, even current, I don't know how many now, but a lot of really good ball players came out of the St. Louis area.
So your first game would have been then at Sportsman's Park, right?
Yeah, before it became Busch Stadium.
What do you remember about Sportsman's Park? What stands out to you?
Well, I remember it was a short right field, and they had a screen that really kind of went up the whole bleachers out in right field, and they had the pavilion roof out there. They took that screen down 1 or 2 years, and I remember, if I'm correct in my thinking, that Richie Ashburn, who was in the Hall of Fame but wasn't a home run hitter, hit a couple home runs in the pavilion there, and they decided to put that screen back up. They realized that was a mistake, I think. So that was I grew up, and I played in a high school championship game there at that ballpark my senior year at University City High School in St. Louis, a suburb of St. Louis, which was a thrill for me to be on the field there. But
to think that you're on the same, playing on the same field that your childhood hero, Stan Musial.
Well, for me, it was just great. And what a thrill, you know, just being on that field. You know, I was one of these wide-eyed kids that got a chance to see big league baseball. But when you get a chance to be on the field and just walk on the grass that all these great stars played on, to me, it was real thrill. And then when I signed a contract, professional contract, there was no draft. So you have a choice to sign with whoever you want. I had a number of teams that were interested in me, but the Cincinnati Reds, who I eventually signed with, worked me out at that ballpark back in the, I don't remember what year it was. I had signed in the winter of 1959, my first year in the minor leagues was 60. So it had to be sometime in the summer of 1959. And I'm really a young kid. And I worked out on the field and, gosh, they had Frank Robinson and they had all these great players. They let me take batting practice with the extra men. I mean, I probably weighed 150 pounds back then, but I was on the field with all these great players. So,
did you have any conversations with Frank Robinson when you are like a high school kid trying out?
I was so nervous at that time when they worked me out, but I will tell you this. Fred Hutchinson was the manager. He was so nice to me. And I'll never forget a gentleman by the name of Wally Moses, who was their hitting coach, took me aside and talked to me about hitting. Now, I believe I'm 17 years old, wide-eyed, in awe of everybody. I'm sure I listened to what he had to say, but my attention was just the fact that I was on this field with these guys. But I can't tell you how nice they were. And really, I was skinny as a rail, and they had the vest uniforms. And so I was kind of overwhelmed with being in this vest uniform and not really fitting into it. But what a thrill for me. And I look back on these things that you remember as a kid growing up.
Were you able to keep the vest, or did you have to give that back?
No, I would never even begin to think that I could keep the vest. I folded it like it was a brand new sweater that I just bought, laid it on the stool that I was dressing at. But gosh, you got to picture this. I'm 17 years old. I'm in this locker room, which was, if I remember correctly, wasn't the best. It was the old Sportsman's Park.
You probably had a lot of their baseball cards.
I probably did. You're right. I remember even before that, some friends of mine decided we wanted to go say hello to someone. It just happened to be the Cincinnati Reds. They were staying at the Chase Hotel in St. Louis, a big hotel, midtown St. Louis. So we went there. We were standing in the lobby. Back then, security wasn't really great. And I remember Veda Pinson came down and we said hello to him, and he was really nice. So I had this great thing with the Cincinnati Reds that part of the reason, I guess, I ended up signing with them. But then I got to be teammates with both Veda and Frank, and they were always nice to me. And, you know, and then, of course, Frank was only there when I was there 1 year because he ended up getting traded to the Baltimore Orioles. But I played with Veda, and I played with some great players with the Reds back in the 60s. And it was a prelude to the big red machine.
Yeah, so backtrack just for a second. Your career begins, as you said, you get signed in fall 1959. Your career begins the following year in New York, the New York Penn League, playing for the Geneva Redlegs. Who was your roommate?
Pete Rose. He didn't get there till June. So there was a four or five of us that rented a house on the street, a small street in Geneva. I guess somebody from the ball club had recommended it. And then Pete joined us. I tell this story that it was myself, Pete, and Tony Perez were on this team. And we were so bad as a team, we got our manager fired in the middle of the season. And both those guys, Pete and Tony, had to play another year of Class D baseball, was the lowest classification, because all of us weren't prospects or suspects. We were suspects, yeah. And they kept those guys in Class D another year. Back then, the Reds had two Class D teams, one in Geneva, New York, and one in Tampa, Florida. They kept Tony there the next year in 61, and they moved me to Class B, Topeka, Kansas. They sent Pete to Tampa, where he played another year, because if you would have saw Pete play in 1960, you would have said, there's no way he's ever going to accomplish anything. He couldn't do anything except run hard to first base after a walk. He wasn't a good hitter, wasn't a good fielder. He didn't really throw well, but he could run and run hard to first base after a walk. And when he got on base, he could run hard. But he wasn't really the ball player that he became until a couple years later when we were together in Macon, Georgia in 1962.
It sounds like if someone had asked you back then, is this guy going to go on to have a great major league career? You would have said, yeah, probably not.
None of us really at that point we were mostly suspects. We weren't even prospects. And
you're 18 at the time.
Yes, I'm 18. And the next year I go to Topeka, Kansas, and we have a really good team. Reds at that time really had a lot of good young ball players. They had about seven or eight minor league teams, if I'm not mistaken. Dave Bristol was a manager. I played with Tommy Harper, who went on to the big league, a great big league career.
Yeah.
Bell Queen, who went on to play baseball in the big league, but also became a pitching coach, I believe, with Cleveland. Tommy Helms, who played a big league, was rookie of the year 1 year with the Reds as a shortstop, second baseman. And I played with some really good ball players on that team. We won the pennant. And then the next year, they moved me to Macon, Georgia, which was A-ball. And then, of course, Pete was there and a number of good ball players. And I saw the change from Pete to being what he was in 1960 at Geneva to really a terrific ball player. And I don't know what his final stats were. I think he led the league in hitting, if I'm not mistaken, in Macon, but he was a completely different ball player. And, you know, the next year they brought him to spring training. He made the Reds roster, and the rest is history. But
just a quick side note, the 1960 season, when you're playing for the Geneva Redlegs, I know it's true that you had a few more ABs than Pete did, but still it should be noted that you finished the season with more hits than baseball's future all-time hit king. That's a pretty cool feather in your cap.
Well, probably because I was there longer, but I wasn't a good hitter. I was a decent hitter. I learned to be a better hitter as I got older. And, you know, back in all those days I played, we really didn't have the great coaching. I remember even with the Mets, we didn't even have a hitting coach. I mean, and even with the Reds, there really wasn't any hitting coach. So you really had to learn on your own. And then And fortunately, I looked at guys. I watched all the great players I got a chance to play with and against, and really kind of worked on my hitting. But something happened to Pete in that transformation. And he had this great year in 62. Spring of 63, he wasn't a roster player. They've just brought a number of us to spring training, and Pete made the team. And that was the beginning of the Charlie Hustle nickname and all the great records he put up.
So on your way through the minor leagues, you spent a couple of seasons, I think it was 63 and 64, with the AAA San Diego Padres, who play their home games at Westgate Park, which at the time, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was regarded as one of the nicer minor league ballparks in baseball. It was later torn down when San Diego Stadium, which became Jack Murphy Stadium, was built. The famous Fashion Valley Mall now stands on its footprint. But what do you remember about Westgate Park, playing there in 63 and 64?
What a beautiful place. If you had to pick a place to play minor league baseball, and I played there 2 years, it couldn't be better than San Diego. Fell in love with the city out there. Ballpark was this beautiful little ballpark in this valley. And we had great teams both years I was there. Again, the organization had so many good players. And I believe we did win the championship 1 year. Stayed out there one winter, married with one daughter at the time. She was born in California. Stayed there, and not knowing that I was going to be back there again, but I have no regrets. I had to play 2 years out there because when I got to the Reds, they had Frank Robinson in right field, Veta Pinson in center. Darren Johnson was playing the outfield, Tommy Harper. Even Pete Rose went out the outfield a little bit. So it was very difficult for me to make that team, you know, as a very young player. So I had to go back to AAA 2 years in a row. Also, picture this. When I signed, there was only 16 teams, and then they expanded in 1962 to 20. So now there's only 20 teams in the major leagues. So the reality is that it was very difficult back in the early 60s to make a major league roster because there just was no room. And so flip side of that is I got a chance to play against great, great players who couldn't make it to the big leagues because they were in the situation I was in. There just was no room for them. And that Coast League in both the years, if you look at the roster of some of those teams, they had great pitchers who went on to have fabulous careers in the big leagues and terrific ball players field in the field and hitters. And for me to play against those guys who were in the same situation as me, it was very, very special.
Footnote to Westgate Park, you hit the longest home run in Westgate Park history, a 500-foot blast. Do you remember that home run?
Because the wind was blowing out. That's all folklore. I don't really remember that too much, but I could say yes, and I would be telling a fib. I hit some decent balls out of that ballpark, but I'd have to see video of that to be accurate.
Well, and by the way, there was a moment in the mid-1960s where the Milwaukee Braves were considering a move west, and so plans were actually drawn up, blueprints, to add another deck onto Westgate in order to make it major league ready for the Braves should they consider San Diego an option. Obviously, they didn't. They ended up moving to Atlanta. But in 65, you made the Reds ball club out of spring training. At that point, the Reds were playing at historic Crosley Field.
It's a beautiful night for baseball here in Cincinnati. The temperature today right around 80 degrees. Still a small amount of twilight in the sky. And it's baseball here at Crosley Field. The dimensions of the ballpark down the left field line is 328 feet. Out in left field, behind the left fielder, it goes out to 378. Then there's a high scoreboard that runs approximately 50 to 60 feet in the air, moving over to almost left center. The deepest part of the left center field area is 383 feet, and then a fence extends across to right center field, 390 feet. Coming down towards the right field foul line being 366 feet away, and in right center field, right in back of the right fielder, it's 360 feet. It's an unusual ballpark, and it's a good ballpark for hitters. Hitters being able to hit straight away in the ballpark and take advantage of the short center field fence.
What made Crosley Field special?
It was the first ballpark that had lights. I remember that, and it had the terrace in the field. A lot of people younger people won't remember this or won't know about it, but they had a field that when you got to the outfield, the warning track basically was a terrace that went up by probably a 30-degree angle. And it went all the way around. It was a little less in right field because I spent most of the time in right field, but it was really high in left field. The reason they did it because fans would come, they would let fans on the field. So in order for them to see, they had to be elevated higher than the outfielders. So that was the original reason for the terrace. But, you know, it was one of these older ballparks. And in the National League back in those days, they had a lot of the older ballparks. And these are ballparks you watch as a kid growing up.
Where were the clubhouses? They were behind the grandstand, right?
Yeah, both of them were. You had to walk through the stands down the third base line. And if you walked, sometimes you had to walk with the opposing team together. And that was a little hairy times because there was some, not bad blood, but, you know, it might have been a tough game and you but you had to do that. And when you got to it, I believe the visitor's clubhouse was to the left and the Reds clubhouse was to the right.
I mean, you're interacting with the fans literally every single day because you have to walk right past them.
You're exactly right. There was a closeness back in those days to the fans, I think, more so as years went on. You know, security got tighter. Back in those days, you were literally right next to the fans walking off. And if I'm not mistaken, most of the ballparks were pretty close to third base lines and first base lines were pretty close. There wasn't a real long run to get to the dugout or walk to the dugouts on each side. So I do remember that.
Your first year in the big leagues, you played at some of baseball's most memorable old ballparks. I'd love to just touch on a few, and if you could recall one or two things that made each one of these parks unique or interesting to you, starting with Philadelphia's Connie Mack Stadium.
Tonight, the Mets meet the Philadelphia Phillies here in Connie Mack Stadium, and Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, and I on hand to bring you every bit of the action. So how about checking your own supply of fine cold Rheingold, Rheingold Extra Dry? Yes, sir, put some Rheingold on ice, because it can add a lot to your enjoyment of the game.
You know what's interesting about... People always say, who was the toughest pitcher? And I always say it was really a pitcher that couldn't see the ball, you know. And a lot of ballparks, for some reason, you just didn't see the ball come out of the pitcher's hand. But Connie Mack, I remember I could see the ball really good. And I had some really good games. But it was an old ballpark. Remember the roof that overlapped the left field stands? Remember Richie Allen used to pepper balls up on that roof. He could hit the ball so far, but...
There was a Coke billboard on top of that roof. Years ago, I asked him, I said, what do you remember most about Connie Mack Stadium? And he just said, the Coke sign.
Yeah, he hit it a few times. And I saw him do that. He, such a strong hitter, used a heavy bat. But the thing I remember about Connie Mack, it seemed like you could hear everybody who was yelling from the stands. You could hear people getting on players. I don't know why. That just stands out in my mind. But I think the thing I remember about that ballpark was that it was high wall and round run right to right field and then stands and left. And of course, the roof, like we talked about with the advertisements on the roof. But
yeah,
one thing I remember is that I could see the ball pretty good there.
What about Forbes Field in Pittsburgh?
This, ladies and gentlemen, is Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. No longer is Pittsburgh the smoky city, but instead one of the most beautiful and dynamic of them all.
Big ballpark, not tremendously long down the right field, but it jetted out. Big poke to left field. Of course, that's the famous 1960 home run.
From Bill Mazeroski in the 1960 World Series, yeah.
Yogi in left field. But a huge drive to center field. You needed a cannon to hit one out to center field. And they had the batting cage out there that they used to wheel out. I don't even know if it was protected by a fence or anything, but...
No, they just would wheel it out after batting practice and stick it out in center field. And I was talking to Steve Blass, former pitcher for the Pirates, and I said, well, did you have to worry about it, like getting hit? He's like, no, I mean, it was so far out there.
I never saw a ball go over the fence, Derek. I saw some balls in left field, number of balls in right field. For me, a kid playing in that ballpark against Clemente and Mazeroski, and some of those great players from those teams, for me, it was a thrill. I looked at it as just lucky to be there. And the other guy is Stargell. I forgot to mention him.
I imagine there were times that you're out in the outfield at Forbes Field. You're catching a Clemente pop fly or Stargell pop fly. And it's got to feel surreal to know that I just retired one of the great players of all time.
Yeah, it really did. You hit it right on the nose. I used to come out during batting practice. You weren't supposed to fraternize. They had fraternizing rules back then, but I used to come out in batting practice and just watch some of these great players. I didn't get too close to the cage, but I just wanted to see them swing. And I was in awe. You know, I used to love to play first base for a couple of reasons. I got a chance to you're in the game more, so you didn't have to think about your hitting or anything. You know you might get the ball every time. But you got a chance to say hello to some of these great players. And just remember being able to say hello to Stargell and McCovey and all the great hitters of those and Billy Williams and Mays. I mean, just for them to even look at me and acknowledge me, to me, was very, very special.
You played at the Astrodome 2 months after it opened.
This is the Astrodome, truly the eighth wonder of the world.
The Reds were in town in Houston in May of 65. What did you think of the Astrodome? Obviously, it's unlike anything you had ever seen up to that point, I'm sure.
Well, that was one ballpark you couldn't see at all. I mean, they didn't even paint the tiles, whatever they called them, the glass things up at the ceiling. You know, it was hard to see a ball pitch, and it was hard to see a ball come off the bat. And I think they finally decided to do something there. But that was just a And that was a huge ballpark. I hit one home run there in the years I played the big leagues. It was just a ballpark that was scary to look at when you were driving up to see it. And once you got in, it was scary to be inside it, too. But, you know, when I say scary, I don't really mean it in the sense that it was just kind of different. It wasn't like the ballparks we were used to. But I do remember it was just very difficult to see the ball hitting and fielding out there.
August 12th, 1966, you were brought in a game in the eighth inning, I think as part of a double switch.
A big hand on Art Shamsky.
What happened next, Art, is the stuff of legend, and why your bat from that day is on display at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown.
I came in a game in the eighth inning, and like you said, a pitcher's hitter switch, and I forgot who was playing right field at the time. He made the last out, I believe, in the previous inning, so Dave Bristol was the manager. Went out, changed pitchers, put me in right field. So now I'm hitting in the pitcher's spot. We're losing the game. This is a game. There was a lot of home runs in this game. The wind was blowing out. But I hit a home run in the bottom of the eighth. I don't remember if it put us ahead or tied the game. We went into extra innings, and I proceeded to hit two more home runs in extra innings to tie the game. We ended up losing in the 14th. Normally, you think if you're home and you hit two home runs in extra innings, you're going to win the game. But we ended up losing the game. This is, like you said, this is a story. It's hard to believe. So I hit three home runs, and I think today I am still the only player in baseball history to hit three home runs in the game who wasn't in the starting lineup.
That's right.
Anyway, now the next day we're rained out. The next day is Sunday. Two of the home runs were against right-handers, one is against left-handers. And Vernon Law, really good right-hand pitcher, is pitching the game, and I'm not in the starting lineup. I was not one of these guys that wanted to confront a manager back then. I was very low-key. To a fault. I probably wish I would have been a little bit more outspoken, but I don't start the game. He sends me in the fifth or sixth inning to pinch hit. We're losing the game. I hit another home run to put us ahead in that game, four home runs in a row, and we ended up losing that game. I don't know what the score was, 6-5 or something like that.
I would be thinking, hey, Skip, what's a guy got to do?
Here's an addendum to that story. We leave that night and we go to L.A. We're playing the next night in L.A. And I forget who's starting. I think it's Sutton or somebody. I'm not sure. And I'm not in the starting lineup then. For whatever reason, I should have talked to him then. But he sends me up to pinch hit in the seventh. I've got a hard-throwing right hitter by name Bob Miller. And I single to right field. I hit the ball right on the button, single to right field. So I've got five or six hits in a row. But it was a time where, you know, it's hard to explain why these things happen. You know, maybe the ball looked a little bit bigger than it normally did for some reason. But you get in these little spells. And what's interesting about that, though, like you mentioned, the bat's in the Hall of Fame and people still talk about it. I have people coming up to me said they were listening to the game. I don't know how old they are, but they were listening to the game and Bob Fritz was the announcer for Pittsburgh. And, you know, and it makes me feel good that people still remember. And again, the bat being in the Hall of Fame is very special because I have people come up and say they, if it's not on display, they can ask for it and they'll bring it out. So it's really, really nice for me to have that up there.
You ended up hitting 21 home runs in 1966 and just 234 at-bats, which was the best ratio in Major League Baseball. By the end of 1967, you're traded to the Mets and begin play at Shea Stadium. Now, look, this is just my personal opinion, Art, but I look at photographs of Shea when it opened in 64.
The crack of a baseball bat, the cry homer from 55,000 voices here in the William A. Shea Stadium next to the World's Fair.
This will be the home of the New York Mets, beginning 1964.
It was a sharp-looking ballpark. What were your impressions of Shea when you started playing there?
Shea Stadium was an interesting ballpark. A lot of people didn't like it because it was very noisy. You have LaGuardia Airport right near there. And in some cases, people said they couldn't see the ball well. I didn't feel that way. I saw the ball good. They had this big black backstop and you could look at when you were batting in center field. The planes didn't bind me at all. I never stepped out of the batter's box once because of an airplane. And then, of course, 2 years later, we won the World Series. My life changed. And so playing in that ballpark was really great.
Was it hard to pick pop-ups up because of how high the stadium was? Did you get the ball lost in the upper deck?
You know, it's pretty interesting you bring that up. I didn't have so much trouble with pop-ups. I had a little trouble with the white and people's shirts, the ball coming off the bat. You really had to focus. You know, back in those days, either it was right or left field, mostly right field for me. I could watch the ball come out of a pitcher's hand, you know, almost see it go from his hand to home plate. So I was able to have the really good eyes. And so I followed the ball as closely as I could off the bat. Guys who don't do that sometimes lose the ball in the stands, and particularly in day games. We played a lot of day games in New York back then. You really had to focus, and that was a big problem for me. But back then, I had the great eyes, and so for me, it was okay.
These numbers sound like a video game, but 18-time All-Star, 13-time World Series champion, Yogi Berra was a part of the Mets coaching staff when you were there. And I think he helped out, and I say helped out in quotes, with hitting. I don't know if he was officially a hitting coach, but I can only imagine, given all the Yogi-isms I've heard throughout my life.
Well, if you get hurt and miss work, it won't hurt to miss work. And they give you cash, which is just as good as money.
What kind of hitting instruction would Yogi give you?
Well, interesting enough, Yogi was an idol of mine, obviously, because he grew up in St. Louis. All the Yogi stories you heard of and all the history with the Yankees. But when I got there, they told me he was a hitting coach. But I can honestly tell you, in the years I was there, he never, ever really talked to me about hitting. I remember one day I asked him, I said, Yogi, I'm really having trouble. What should I do? He said, see it and hit it. You know, that was it. So we really didn't have a hitting coach. We didn't have an underground batting cage. It was not the same as it is now. You didn't have the instruction. You know, we worked at it. We did what we had to do. We came out early. We got friends of ours who would throw batting practice to us, and you worked on your own. I think part of my growing up as a ball player, as a hitter, is as a kid, when I first got to the big leagues, I watched great hitters. I watched Frank Robinson in batting practice. I watched him do things that really impressed me. He wasn't a guy that tried to hit the ball out of the ballpark to get the oohs and ahs of fans and batting practice. He tried to hit everything to the right side of the infield as a right-hand batter, just trying to get that left shoulder closed to keep it closed. Then, of course, had all the great years as a home run hitter. But I watch Aaron, and I watch Mays, and I watch Stargell and McCovey. I watch Billy Williams. I mean, I watch these guys who, to me, were just unbelievable hitters. And so if I learned something from them, I took it as something special. And I think as I got older, I learned to hit the ball the opposite field. I learned that there was a lot of base hits to the opposite field. I didn't strike out a lot. I think that was one of the things that made me be very anxious about batting in the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning, looking forward to it, because I knew I wasn't going to strike out. I was going to put the ball in play. So for me, that was half the battle. And so I love that challenge of that confrontation with the really great pitchers, Marichal or Koufax or Drysdale or Gibson, Carlton, Fergie Jenkins. I batted against Seaver twice and when I was with Cincinnati. I mean, all those great pitchers I faced, I watched them, and they were great as the game got on. They got tougher and tougher. But I welcomed that challenge because it was me against them. You know, they know what's coming. The catcher knows what's coming. With two strikes, I'd choke up a little bit, and I'd put the ball in play.
In 1968, Gil Hodges is named manager. Up until that point, the Mets had exactly zero winning seasons, losing, I think, 101-67, 95-66, 112-65, 109-64. Hodges, who helped bring a championship to Brooklyn 13 years earlier, was brought in to bring another one to New York. Now, I'm sure at first being traded, as we talked about, from the Reds to the Mets probably felt like a punch in the gut. Mets were not good, but silver lining for you with Gil Hodges managing, that meant that he would routinely bring in some of his old teammates, Dodger legends like Sandy Koufax, Carl Erskine, Carl Furillo, Pee Wee Reese, to help coach and help teach some things.
That was unbelievable for me. Seeing those guys that I idolized as a kid, I got a chance to meet Roy Campanella. I got a chance to meet all the great Dodgers of that era. We're very, very special when they'd have old timers day and they'd all come around. And Gil was a very tough manager, ex-Marine. Served in World War II, decorated soldier. He was no nonsense. And I remember the first day in spring training in 1968, his first year, my first year, Al Weiss, who came over, J.C. Martin, Tommy Agee, all of us were there for the first time. And Gil had this meeting and he said, listen, I just want you guys to know you're not going to be the same old Mets you've been in the past. Well, which just told me he's not going to tolerate bad baseball. But I wasn't there in the past, so I don't know. You know, I just took it, you know, that he was going to be tough and no nonsense, and he was, and he was right in that. And even though we didn't play great 68, you could see that there was the beginnings of something going to be good. We had really good young pitching. And then the next year in 69, we had the same meeting or very first day or so in spring training, and he said, you know, you guys lost a lot of games by one run, somewhere in the 30s. Got to find ways to win those games, whether it's 10-9, 7-6, 5-4, 2-1, shutouts, whatever it is. Find ways to win those games.
Yeah.
And he was right. And we started to do that.
The Mets got the message. Think big, think positive. They put together some outstanding talent. Art Chamsky and others were making it possible for manager Gil Hodges to throw his best bats at the opposition.
started to fall into place in June, and then in August, when we were still 9 games behind the Cubs, we started to play great baseball, and we were just unbelievable from the middle of August on.
And backtrack just for a second. July 20th, 1969, the Mets have just defeated the Montreal Expos at Gerry Park right at the All-Star break. Your flight back to New York was delayed, but that gave you and your teammates an opportunity to pull up a chair at the airport bar in Montreal and watch history unfold.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, by fate, there was trouble on the plane, engine trouble. So we were, you know, just at the Montreal airport. I don't know what time we finally got out of there. We watched this incredible event taking place. And somebody in the back of the room, it could have been Tug McGraw, it could have been Seaver, it could have been anybody. I don't remember. Somebody yelled out, hey, if they can walk on the moon, the Mets can win the pennant. You know, we all laughed because it was very profound, but there was something to be said there. It was one of those years where so many big events happen in the world. And, you know, I wrote a book called The Magnificent Seasons, which kind of categorized all these things. I used lines from the papers, were just events that happened during the course of the year. It was not only about us, but it was about the Jets, Knicks, who also won championships in that period of time. But it was very profound in a sense because there were so many bad things happening in the city of New York and the country that I just used timeline events to talk about. While these teams were doing great, the world was upside down. And I just remember that, how profound New York City, the world was so bad in terms of bad things happening, the war in Vietnam. I mean, just the everything was going bad, but we and the other two teams really kind of made people feel better about their lives. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. I've still people coming up to me today telling, just saying thank you. Vietnam veterans, family members who are still around, and grandchildren and kids who weren't even born know about those teams, in particular the Mets, from their parents and their grandparents. And for me, that's very, very special, because anytime you can help somebody in their life, I think you accomplish something. So I always feel good about that.
By the All-Star break, the Mets were 53-39.
The reason for the New York Mets' success in 1969 certainly has been a great team effort, I think. I believe this is the best team effort of any ball club I've ever seen.
And then from August 16th through the rest of the season, your two pitching legends, Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman, go on a tear.
Really start breaking it down. You have to say that pitching is the backbone of our attack, headed by Tom Seaver, who had a great year.
Winning 17 of their last 18 decisions, and the Miracle Mets finished with 100 wins, which was, I mean, let's put it how it was, absolutely unthinkable.
It's your madness in the clubhouse. Champagne, congratulations, laughter, and cheering. This team is number one, just as their fans, who've been number one for years. Big Shay, a scene of celebration tonight.
There was no one who predicted this would happen, Art. No one.
Well, you're absolutely right. And everybody thought we were going to lose the Atlanta Braves, who had a pretty good team. I don't know if they won 100 games that year, but they had Aaron and Filippo Lu and Rico Cardi and Orlando Cepeda. They didn't have the pitching we had, but they had the hitting. And they really hammered the ball those three games, I guess, in the playoffs. That was the first year of the playoffs. Our pitching didn't really hold up, but we had the hitting, and the hitting came through. I got 7 hits and 13 at-bats. Kenny Boswell did great. Wayne Garrett did great. Eddie Cranefield did great. And we swept Atlanta, and now we go to play a Baltimore Oriole team that won 108 games, if I'm not mistaken, that year.
Next scene, Memorial Stadium in Baltimore. All the Mets have to do is beat the Orioles, the best American League team to go into a World Series since the Yankees of 1961.
Yeah.
Everybody thought we were going to lose 4 in a row. And I rightfully so. They looked at us as, you know, some sort of hard to explain how we won 100 games.
Memorial Stadium was not an easy ballpark for hitters to play in. The White Houses in the day that were beyond the center field fence, Jim Palmer talked about this in season one of the Lost Ballparks podcast, that it was tough for hitters during the day to pick up the ball out of a pitcher's hand because of those houses.
Yeah, I had to pinch hit in that first game. I have the distinction of making the last out of the first game that we lost in the World Series, and everybody thought we were going to lose 4 in a row, and we ended up winning 4 in a row after that. But I don't remember that particular thing being so tough to see. I remember Mike Cuellar threw a pitch right down the middle that I grounded out the second. Every time I would see him all the subsequent years, I said to Mike, threw a pitch right down the middle of the plate. I could have hit it out of the ballpark. And we laugh about that all the time, but I think about that at bat almost every day of my life. But we were lucky. We split the series there. Won the next game. Jerry Kuzman pitched great.
One game, two. The series was tied at one apiece, and then I think it came back to Shea. The stadium was packed.
We're standing out here outside the stadium, and these are typical Mets fans. What's your name, son?
Bobby Weber.
Who's your favorite player?
Eddie Cranepool and Cleon Jones.
Yeah, what's your name?
Karen Jagutski.
Karen, you look like you might be a Mets fan, are you?
I certainly am.
Are we going back to Baltimore?
No, we're
going
to win them all here.
Who is your favorite Mets player?
Ron Swoboda and Art Chomsky.
And a 22-year-old Nolan Ryan made the only World Series appearance of his 27-year Hall of Fame career in Game 3.
With the Braves still ahead and two men on, he brings in fireballer Nolan Ryan to whiff a third strike past Rico Carty.
Picking up the save, giving New York the win in that game, Seaver pitched an absolute gem in Game 4, and then Jerry Kuzman, as you mentioned, finished off the Orioles in Game 5. And against all odds, you and your teammates were world champions.
Look who's number one. The world champions of baseball, the New York Mets.
The champagne flows again. The ticker tape pours down on Broadway. Sophisticated New Yorkers go crazy over the amazing Mets.
It had to feel special, again, knowing that coming in, just like all year long, no one even gave the Mets a fighting chance in that series.
Well, you know, I tell everybody this, Mike, my life changed October 16th, 1969. I played 13 years and nobody really talks about the other 12. You have somebody who'll bring up Cincinnati Reds and the four home runs in a row, but really everybody knows about the 69 Mets. And for me, everything has changed in terms of what I've been able to do, write two books. I'm working on a third one. They named the dog after me and everybody loves Raymond. I've been on so many talk shows. I've done so many podcasts. I've had the opportunity to be on the Ed Sullivan show of it, the Dick Cavett show. I mean, so many things, wonderful things happened to me. And people today, whenever they hear my name, still in New York, not as much as it used to be, but still in New York, people recognize and associate me with that 1969 Met team. And to be part of that group of 31, including coaches, just is very, very special. Unfortunately, we've lost a number of guys from that team, but
yeah,
but there's still a nucleus around. And I might be crazy and you might disagree with me, but I think there's a couple teams in the history of baseball that you can talk about 50 years later and people still recognize the name and associate certain things with that year. One of them is the 27 Yankees, of course, with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and that great cast of great players on their team. And the other is the 69 Mets. Now, we might not have household names, but they'll remember that we beat the Orioles or remember we came from nowhere. They'll remember the Black Cat incident.
Right.
There are a lot of things that happened that year.
The imperfect game.
And the perfect, near perfect game, and Steve Carlton striking out 19 and losing the game to a pair of home runs that Ron Swoboda hit. I mean, you just can't write this stuff. You can't make it up. And I think this legacy has passed on from generation to generation. For me to be part of that, no matter what I've done in my baseball career, my life, I'll always be associated with being part of that team. And I don't think you can write a better script.
No, you can't. And the icing on the cake, too. Do you remember after Game 5 of that 69 World Series, do you remember what happened after the game in the clubhouse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. I got my dad to come in. My dad, who had taken me out as a 4 or 5 year old and soft tossed with me. And I think that was a thrill for him to be in there and see the celebration, what we had accomplished. He had met a number of the players during the course of the years I played there. But I mean, to be in that locker room for that celebration, that was the days when champagne was flowing, but you weren't wearing goggles. You were getting doused and it was burning and everybody was getting doused.
Don, what is that dripping off of you, Don?
That's a little champagne. I get it in my ear, but never in my mouth.
And listen, I'll end with this, Art. In your book, which I highly recommend, After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets, you mentioned that a few years ago, you and some of your teammates from that 69 team, Bud Harrelson, Ron Swoboda, Kuzman, all make a trip out to Northern California to spend the day reminiscing with teammate Tom Seaver. Do you remember the story that Seaver told about your clubhouse guy, Jimmy? Him playing Jim Rummy in between innings.
Oh, yeah, when he was pitching. I remember that. Yeah. Well, you know, everybody's got a crazy story or two. Yeah. Well, he was no nonsense. He came up for a couple minutes, played some gin, and then went right back out and pitched. And he was a great pitcher. I have an interesting story if you want to hear about him real quick.
Absolutely.
With the Reds, I hit a pinch hit in the ninth inning off him at Shea Stadium. He was winning the game 7-0. It was a game in June, I believe. And I hit a 3-run home run, pinch hit home run. It was a meaningless home run in the sense of the score, but I hit a home run off him. And then I got traded over to the Mets. And during spring training, when I first came over to say hello to him, I didn't really know a lot of guys. I knew Eddie Cranepool. I knew a couple of the guys. And I came over and said, hey, Tom, it's Art Chomsky. And he said, I know who you are. He said, I remember that day in June here at Shea Stadium, too. I tell you what, we'll talk about it today, but we'll never talk about it again. And we never did. And so, but that trip out to see him was very special. I was just, Eric Sherman, a great writer, and I were writing this book called After the Miracle. And we wanted to do these interviews, but I did not want to do an interview over the phone with Tom. He had just announced that he was suffering from, they originally thought it was Lyme disease, but now it was dementia. And so we wanted to take a trip, and we rolled the dice, talked to his wife about coming out. He said, talk to my wife. She's got my schedule. And she said to me, you know, you can get out here. He might not feel good. It might be a waste of trip. So Eric and I thought about it. We said, let's roll the dice. And we wanted to take a couple guys. Buddy Harrelson had just announced that he was suffering from Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. They were roommates and grew up in California. I thought it would be great for them to spend some time together. Kuzman was the next best, great next best pitcher on that team. And Swoboda had made the great catch in game 4 to save the game and a victory for Tom. And so we decided to get the guys out and had to bring them in from different flights. And we went out there and, again, rolled the dice. We went on a Friday night. We met at the San Francisco airport. It worked out great. And we got there and I called Tom and Nancy, see if we got on the phone. She said, this is not a good day. He's not feeling well. And then really, the reality of it is we only had one day, the next day, Saturday, because we all had to leave early Sunday to catch our flights back. And we went out that night, Friday night, and we stayed about 30 miles away from where he's up in Calistoga. And we went out to dinner and we just talked about this and we just kind of said a little prayer and said, let's hope that he's feeling okay the next day, which was Saturday. I called in the morning. She said, get over here as soon as you can. And she finished off the sentence with saying, but when you get here, tell him his coffee tastes great, even if it tastes bad. He's making some coffee for you. So we got up there as soon as we could, had the coffee. I don't remember if it tasted good or not. It tasted good to me because we got there and we got to see him. And we spent about 8 hours with him and walking around his house. And he's got a lot of acres, but 3 acres were the grapes where he grows the grapes. And he went out and showed us how we did it and how beautiful this valley was, and reminisced with him about his time with the Mets, our time with the Mets, our time with him. Went out to lunch. He spent this miraculous, and I say miraculous because for all of us, it was so touching to be out there with him. And even though he had announced that he was ill, he was able to communicate with us. And he was redundant in some phrases and some sentences, but all in all, it was wonderful. And we left out there after spending all this time. To me, I was very melancholy because in a sense, we were almost saying goodbye to a teammate and a friend and a real legend in a sense, because he was one, I think Chris Rioshio was one of the greatest pitchers of all time. But to be able to get out there and salvage our time and be able to be with him was so, so special and very important to the book. The book is not about Tom Seaver, but it's about the friendship and camaraderie you developed over the years from being a bad team to go ahead and winning a World Series. It was very important for us to share these moments with Tom. So I'll always be grateful that we were able to get out to see him.
Yeah, and that is the final chapter of the book. And I finished that last night and was spellbound. I just was captivated by every single word in that chapter and thought it was so well done, and appreciative that you and Eric put that book together, After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. And Art, what a privilege, and just grateful for the time that you have given today and just fun reminiscing with you.
Mike, thank you so much. And if anybody is interested, they can follow me on Twitter at Art Shamsky. And also they can go to my website, artshamsky.com. I've got some memorabilia. I've got the books there. I literally got some nice stuff to reminisce a little bit about the 69 team. So I thank you for taking the time. You did a great job. I appreciate it. And good questions. And best of luck to you and your fans.
All right. Hey, thank you, Art, so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. Anytime.
One of my favorite TV shows over the past 2 to 3 decades was Everybody Loves Raymond, starring Ray Romano. Ray grew up in Queens and is a lifelong Mets fan, so it's no surprise that when it came time to give the bulldog who appeared on the show a name, Ray chose Shamsky.
Oh, Robert loved that dog. He named him Shamsky after his favorite ball player.
Art Shamsky.
Right, right.
If you'd like to check out Art's book, After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets, I'll have a link for you down in the podcast notes. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by John Carter, Mike Lipinski, Alex Kemp, Mandy Zablakis, Briggs Buckingham, Kyle Schmidt, Mike Dunn, Xavier Guerra, and Ryan Beard. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next week for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.